Okay, thanks everyone for coming. So today I'm going to talk about the relationship between asana or posture, sukha or bliss or happiness, and meditation in early yoga, by which, as you'll see shortly, I mean not just the Patanjali yoga tradition, but also early Buddhist practices that are very similar but are not always labeled as yoga in the Buddhist texts themselves, especially in the early tradition. And I have a PowerPoint. Unfortunately, no pictures are included, but I'll be talking about some textual passages, so I thought it would be useful to have them handy. The earliest major text in the Brahminical tradition to talk about asana in the context of yoga and to use the term asana itself is the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, attributed to Patanjali, to which there is a commentary attributed to Vyasa, although it's been argued that maybe both were authored by the same person. For the purposes of this talk, I don't need to take any stance on this issue, but I thought you may want to be aware of that. And the Patanjali Yoga Shastra says very little about asana. There are just three sutras that are quite cryptic. And the passage has been edited by Philip Maas. There is a critical edition in his 2018 article, which deals in quite a lot of detail with these three sutras. And he does an excellent job in discussing the asanas that are listed in the commentary and in discussing the later commentaries. But there was one aspect of his work that I thought I could build on. What the yoga suras say are sthira sukham asanam, and then prayatna shatilyanantya samapatibhyam, which Maas translates as a steady and comfortable posture arises from a slackening of effort or from merging meditatively into infinitively. When I first read the Yoga Sutras, this posed a problem of interpretation for me, because asana is the third anga in its system of eight angas, and it seems to be a preliminary to meditation. Whereas according to Sutra 247, we actually need to have some kind of meditative attainment to actually perfect asana. And what I'm going to do in this talk is I'm going to look at some Buddhist passages that I think provide a background to these sutras, and that may provide some insight into what this meditative attainment may be, and also what the background, this mentioning of prayatna shaithilya, slackening of effort in Maas's translation, might be. And then at the end of the talk, I'll come back to these sutras and see if we can maybe improve the interpretation of them. And it's already been suggested by both Maas and Vyastik in the same volume that there may be a Buddhist background to these sutras, and specifically to the Anantya Samapati mentioned in the second of the sutras. And both of them point out that there is an early Buddhist list of meditative states. There are eight of them. First there are four dhyanas, and then there are four ayatanas, and the eight of them are collectively known as samapatis. And the first two samapatis deal with something that is infinite, infinity of space and infinity of consciousness, and therefore there seems to be a very close overlap in terminology. They also talk about these samapatis of infinity. So, for example, they mention the Akasanachayatana in Pali, where the middle word in the compound would be Anantya, corresponding to what we find in the Buddhist text. It seems somewhat implausible that this would be in the background here, or at least in the way it's understood in the Buddhist tradition, because these are quite advanced meditative attainments that are quite deep into this list of eight states. And most importantly, they are in no way whatsoever linked with the Sukha, which is mentioned in the Yoga Sutras. And in fact, they're positively not linked with the Sukha, because these are states where there is no longer any feeling of anything, actually, of any sensation. The feeling of Sukha is mentioned in these Buddhist states, but it is only found in the first three dhyanas. But by the time we get to the Samapatis, there is no longer any Sukha. And so again, as I mentioned before, it seems a priori problematic to say that we need to get to this advanced state before we can even master asana, which is in a way a prerequisite for dhyana and samadhi and these meditative states listed in the remaining angas in the Yoga Sutra. So thinking about the early history of asana, we may note that earlier Brahmanical texts such as the Mahabharata show no interest in asana. There are no helpful usages of the term in a yogic context in such texts. It is mentioned in the Shveta Shvatara Upanishad, which however could be dated maybe to the Common Era, so it is not among the earliest Brahmanical texts on yoga. It might be even roughly contemporary with the Yoga Sutras themselves. So looking at texts like the Mahabharata, which has a lot to say about yoga, does not help to think about asana and sukha and meditation. But if you look at Buddhist literature, as Maas points out, the earliest known yogic usage of the term asana is found in Ashvaghosha's Buddha Charita, which is dated to the 1st or 2nd century of the Common Era. And there it refers specifically to the Paryanka posture, which is one of the postures listed in the commentary attributed to Vyasa and the Yoga Sutras as well. But then we can further observe that there are numerous references to Paryanka in early Buddhist literature, and a couple of mentions of Ardha Paryanka, so a half Paryanka posture. And what we could conclude from this is that in the early period, Paryanka is the asana, it is the posture per excellence. So if you want to understand the early history of asana, we should probably be looking at the mentions of this term in early Buddhist literature, and also of mentions of sukha in early Buddhist literature, since it appears in the discussion of asana in the Yoga Sutras. Although the early Buddhist texts don't apply the term asana itself, we should probably be looking at them, and I think that they have been somewhat overlooked. Much of recent scholarship, especially in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, has dealt with their Buddhist background, but to my knowledge, no publication has discussed the passages that I'm going to present today. And most of the works point out the continuities with the Yogacara Buddhism of, again, early Common Era, and don't always go back to the earlier texts such as the Pali Canon from which I'll be citing today. And what is this Paryanka posture? It seems to be no other than what is later known as the Lotus posture. Again, as Maas points out, in the Brahmanical tradition, other texts later, Paryanka seems to be reinterpreted as a supine position. And the word Paryanka itself means a couch. So it seems to be that later on, the idea is that you lie down, as it were, on a couch. And what I believe is going on in the early tradition is that there is a parallel between kings and the Buddha or the yogic practitioner on many levels, and Paryanka is one of the terms that plays into this. And the majority of the usages of the term Paryanka in early literature is in the context of kings or gods who recline on such couches. And then suddenly we hear that also the Buddha adopts a Paryanka when he sits down, but he doesn't have a couch. Or when a monk meditates in the forest, he also sits in this Paryanka posture. And what I would suggest here is that already choosing the term Paryanka to refer to the meditating posture suggests that it is linked to Sukha, that it is a pleasant manner of sitting. And again, I think this plays into a larger portrayal of the ascetic life in the forest as being a means to attaining a more profound and a more stable kind of sukha than the kama sukha, the sukha of sensory pleasures that is experienced by kings and other householders. But we can't go into too much detail here. And so it is widely recognized that the roots of the yogic traditions are in the so-called Shramana movements, of which Buddhism and Jainism survive. Although, as I mentioned before, their earliest literatures are not always fully employed to interpret, for example, the Yoga Sutras. And we find that the early practitioners of these traditions are depicted as living in the forest, and of course in the Buddhist tradition later on monks start living in monasteries, so the context may be a bit different. And when we look at the term Paryanka, or in Pali Palanka, we find it in many stereotyped lists, and in many of them we hear that a certain monk assumes this sitting posture in a secluded place, in this case Aranyagato, gone to a forest, or Dukkhamulagato, gone to a base of a tree, or Sunyagaragato, gone to an empty building. So we imagine this solitary yogi more or less removed from civilization, probably not too removed because this is a bhikkhu or bhikshu who begs for food. But in any case, we find in the texts of Buddhist, Hindu, and Jain traditions various descriptions of the difficulties endured in the forest. So I'm here giving you a quotation from the Jaina Uttara Dhyayana Sutra, translated by Jacobi. So, cold and heat, flies and gnats, unpleasant feelings, and many diseases attack the body. Without flinching, he should bear them, and should not recall to his memory the pleasures he once enjoyed. So, to generalize, it seems that in the Jain tradition, the way they deal with this physical suffering encountered in the forest asceticism is simply to endure it. And of course it has some soteriological value in the Jain tradition, where tapas is practiced to burn away the old karma. But in the Buddhist tradition, there is no value to dukkha, to physical suffering. And in their context, it becomes just a nuisance. It is something that hinders the practice of meditation. And indeed, the concept of sukha seems to be quite central in the Buddhist debates with the Jains, where they say that you reach sukha, you reach happiness by means of happiness, by means of sukha, whereas the Jains say that you reach sukha by means of dukkha. And what I'm going to suggest here is that the Buddhist answer to this problem is that the meditator suffuses his or her body with the feeling of sukha, which cancels out the possible negative feelings encountered in the forest. And this then allows the meditator to meditate for a long time. And again, there are many typical passages where a time of 7 days is mentioned. Either the Buddha meditated for 7 days, or a monk meditates for 7 days before they attain enlightenment. And now there are quite a few textual passages that we could produce from the Buddhist tradition, either from the Pali canon or from later commentarial works and scholastic works like the Visuddhimagga, or again from Sanskrit works. And I'm going to give you just a few passages here due to constraints of time. But yeah, before going into any specific quotes, I just wanted to say a bit more about sukha in the Buddhist tradition, which, as I said, seems to be central to their self-identity. When they contrast themselves with, for example, the Jain tradition. And one important occurrence of sukha is in a list of states experienced by the Buddhist monk. And I'm sorry for not giving a quote here, but normally the list starts with the cultivation of morality, sila, and then due to this the monk experiences prashrabdhi in Sanskrit, which means something like relaxation, and then from relaxation the monk experiences sukha, and then from sukha one's mind becomes a samahita, composed, and then one can enter meditation, one can reach a samadhi. And one thing that I'm suggesting here in relation to the Yoga Sutras, I'll just go back to this, is that in Sutra 247, this Prayatna Shatilya, relaxation of effort, might be a continuation of this quite early Buddhist notion of Prashrabdhi, which in many typical lists directly precedes Sukha. So yeah, if you look at the Buddhist text, we see a direct link between the things that the Yoga Sutras talk about. So there is a relaxation. From relaxation we get sukha, and once we get sukha, our mind is fit to enter meditation. There are no more obstacles to that. And another insight this may provide in the Yoga Sutras is that if we read the text as it is, there seems to be little link provided between the yamas and niyamas and the asana. And I remind you that the yamas in the Yoga Sutra are the ethical observances, such as ahimsa, nonviolence, and so on. And what the Buddhist tradition is saying is that observance of maybe not the same, but similar states, such as similar virtues, such as nonviolence, leads to relaxation, prashrabdhi. Which is then conducive to meditative attainment. And another aspect to emphasize regarding relaxation or prashrabdhi in the Buddhist tradition is that it is both bodily, it is of kaya, of the body, and it is also of the mind, of citta. And so here again we see that there is a link between the body and the mind that gets highlighted if you look into these earlier sources. And this is a broader theme in the early Indian thought. Also explored in the Mahabharata, there is a paper by Frommering on mental and physical pain in the Mahabharata, which highlights some passages that say pretty much the same thing as early Buddhist texts, which is that if we are upset about something, or more relevant to the Buddhist context, let's say we desire something greatly, this torments us mentally and also torments us bodily, so there are physical effects of our mental suffering. And so I'm suggesting that this here feeds into this thinking of feeling sukha in the body and also in the mind, which I think here serves the double function of overcoming the hardships of the forest life and also making the mind composed. So much for Prashrabdhi. Although one thing to note here is that here also Maas's work has been very helpful in his critical edition of the commentary on Yoga Sutra 46. He reconstructs the name of the asana, which is normally given as Yatha Sukham, as is pleasant, as Yatha Prashrabdhi, and he points out that this is a term that occurs exclusively in the Buddhist context, and it was probably replaced by Sukha, because the term was not so common in the Brahminical tradition. But here again, it seems to have been worthwhile to investigate what the term Prashrabdhi actually does in the Buddhist tradition. And so going back to our Yoga Sutra passage, we said that in addition to relaxation of effort, asana becomes sthira sukham, also by means of this ananta or anantya samapati, depending on which manuscript you follow, which is a meditative attainment either on something which is infinite, ananta, or maybe anantya, infinity itself. And what I'm suggesting here is that there is a probably related idea in early Buddhist literature, which they don't call ananta, but with a similar word, aprameya, immeasurable. And we find in some texts that a cultivation of certain immeasurable states is conducive to either the experience of sukha or simply overcoming the dangers of or hardships of forest life. So here I've given you two verses from the Theragata, which is an early Buddhist collection of ascetic poetry, in which we find many descriptions of these early monks meditating in the forest, and which I think is an important text for the understanding of early history of yogic practices, even if the term yoga is not really used in the text itself. And so in these verses, a certain person asks a monk, so how is it that this monk manages to dwell happily in the forest when he's afflicted by vata, wind, and roga, disease, and yeah, the other, this lukha, which means hardship in general? And what the monk responds is piti sukhena vipulena paramano samusayam lukampi abhisamponto viharisami kanane. So he's saying that although he is experiencing lukha, hardship, he is suffusing his body, samusaya, with opulent piti sukhena, happiness and sukha. And unfortunately, this passage does not say what meditative technique exactly is involved here. But what we do see here clearly is that there is a recognition that there are hardships in the forest, and they can be overcome by suffusing the body with the sukha. But this particular passage does not go into more detail about any meditative techniques that are explicitly linked with this suffusing the body with the sukha. So here I've given you a longer passage along with the translation by Norman. And again, here we have a monk who is suffering. The rice is harvested, but it's all gone, and there are no alms, there is no food to be had. And what is recommended here is the recollection, anusmriti, of some immeasurable things, apameya for Sanskrit, apremeya, and these are the immeasurable Buddha and immeasurable doctrine or dharma, and the immeasurable order or sangha, and being mindful of these, or keeping them in mind for anusmriti. What's happening there is that body becomes suffused, in this case, with piti, with for Sanskrit priti, which is a term closely related to sukha in the Buddhist thought. Again, here the so to speak, the mechanism of this meditative technique is not fully explained. But what we have here is a meditative technique that focuses on certain things that are immeasurable, which I'm suggesting is semantically close to infinite. And by focusing on these things, it is possible to pervade the body with a pleasant feeling. And what the monk then says is, I shall fasten on to the four, Merman says, illimitables. So there are these four immeasurable states. And I shall dwell sukhita. And I take it to mean that, again, they will have made me feel sukha. They will have made me feel this feeling of happiness, maybe. Then I shall not perish of the cold. Maybe there is a bit of an editorial combination of verses that were not originally together. But in any case, what we see here is that, again, the context is the hardships of the forest and monastic life. There is no food. It is cold. And there is a meditative technique that deals with the four immeasurable things that allows to suffuse the body with either piti or sukha, that are in any case closely related in the Buddhist literature. Here I'm presenting to you another interesting Buddhist passage. This is from the Ahiraja Sutta, the sutta about the serpent king. And this is a short story about a monk who dies from a snake bite. And what is then said is that this is because this monk did not extend his metta bhavana, his cultivation of, in Sanskrit, maitri, friendliness, benevolence, to the four lineages of snakes. And so the idea here seems to be that if you cultivate maitri, which is friendliness, then in a, we could say, a magical or supernatural way, the beings that could be hostile to you become friendly, and they will no longer harm you. And metta bhavana is one of the brahma viharas that are also known as the four immeasurable meditations, because what the monk does is the monk suffuses all the directions with these attitudes of maitri, friendliness, and so on. And there seems to be some parallel between this suffusing of all directions with, for example, Maitri, and suffusing one's body with a sukha. They're using similar verbs here, but I have been unable to investigate this fully. And yeah, without much explanation, this same text about the King of Snakes has this interesting statement, which says that, again, these three things, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the community, all of them are apamana or apramana, they're immeasurable, but snakes, they have a pramana, they have a measure, they have a limit. So there seems to be some idea in the background that the sufferings of this world are based on limited things, and if there is something unlimited, it maybe transcends this world and it can protect us from these dangers, again in a maybe supernatural or a magical way. Yeah, and so here I'm just giving you a quotation from the Visuddhimagga, which is a later scholastic work in the Theravada tradition, dated to maybe 4th or 5th century of the Common Era, so not far removed from the Yoga Sutras. And this one gives you the benefits of the cultivation of metta bhavana, which here Bhikkhu Nyanamoli translates as loving kindness. And there are 11 benefits, and the ones that are interesting to us are that the deities guard him, namely the monk who cultivates this and perfects this, as well as fire and poison and weapons do not affect him. So here again we learn that this at least one of the immeasurable meditations has the effect that the practitioner is no longer affected by these dangers that may arise. And here just again another little later development from the Visuddhimagga, where it is said that this pasaddhi, which is a prashraddhi that we discussed before, we translated that previously as relaxation. Here it is translated as tranquility, and here it is said that this feeling can be reached by vipassana, which is the insight meditation in the Theravada tradition. And again, the result of this is that there is no fatigue or heaviness or rigidity and so on and so on in his body and his mind, but his body and mind are light, malleable, wieldy, and so on and so on. And he experiences at that time the superhuman delight. And I think that's it, yeah. So there is a lot more that could be said about the Buddhist tradition and what it has to say about meditation in relation to sukha and relaxation, but what I was hoping to show is that it is worth looking into early Buddhist literature and also contemporary Buddhist literature such as the Visuddhimagga and Yogacara, as other people have done, for better appreciating the context of the Patanjali Yoga Shastra. And so returning to our Yoga Sutra passage, going back to this Sthira Sukham Asanam, given that in the Buddhist tradition there is a lot of talk about sukha as a noun, this feeling of sukha, sukha vedana, a pleasant feeling that is experienced by the monks, I think that it would be quite plausible to take sukha as a noun here as well, which would slightly maybe change the emphasis of the sutra. Most translators have taken sthira sukham as a dvandva compound, not all of them, understanding that asana is or maybe becomes sthira, steady, and sukha, comfortable, by means of these two practices mentioned in the next sutra. But maybe, especially observing that most compounds starting with sthira are bahuvrihi compounds, I think it's quite plausible to take sthira sukham as a bahuvrihi compound. And where this might be then saying is that asana becomes such that in it the feeling of sukha is constant by means of these two methods suggested, one of which is prayatna shatilya, relaxation of effort, which as I've suggested might have a wider background of relaxation being a result of moral observances that make one feel blameless and thereby relaxed, and the other technique being samapati, meditative attainment that relates to something which is infinite. And I suggested a few ways this plays out in the Buddhist tradition, such as, for example, the Buddha being something which is immeasurable, and thereby the Buddha being able to maybe protect us from something which has a measure, which is limited, as well as we saw some Buddhist passages that talk about suffusing the body with sukha that then allows to sit in meditation for a long time.